This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, a network of more than 40,000 people dedicated to the appreciation of beer, cider, and mead. Join the AHA for just $3.99 a month at homebrewersassociation.org. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 1st, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Adam Ross of Twin Span Brewing in Bettendorf, Iowa, talks about two fun and completely different brews, Dampf Beer and Tepache. Adam set himself with the challenge of brewing a new beer each week, and that's taking him into uncharted territory, at least for himself. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way very, very much. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Steve and I got together and recorded two episodes of Basic Brewing Video. And if everything went well, technically, financial supporters will get early releases, behind-the-scenes videos, and recipes from those. The first was about what I'm calling my Porchtoberfest, where I took German ingredients and made a simple smash beer with Pog Kveikyeast from Imperial. It's just Vienna malt and Hallertau Mittelfrü pitched at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 32 C, and sat out on the porch for a while to ferment. It was in the 80s during the daytime when I brewed, and so it was happily fermenting within just a couple hours out there on the porch. I did take it inside overnight because it was a cooling off. I wanted it to be sort of in the spirit of Oktoberfest, but the farmhouse yeast really made it something different and special. Also, we shot an episode finally on my attempt to make a hard seltzer. After all the hullabaloo on the stuck fermentation and such, the results are not horrible. It's not exactly a ringing endorsement, but for a style of beverage I'm not necessarily drawn to, that's pretty good. It's actually growing on me, to tell the truth, and I do want to take another stab at it to see if I can master the process a little better, and I might play with some more flavorings if I do it again, and I probably would. Hey, if you haven't done so already, check out the new fledgling recipe section that we're working on at basicbrewing.com. If you go to basicbrewing.com/recipes, you can see a recipe, the one recipe. But it's for, you got to start somewhere, right? But it's for a delicious basic cider from Steve Wilkes at stevesbrewshop.com. It features A40GF Bubbles yeast from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. The plan is to have a new recipe featuring an Imperial strain every month or so. Imperial Bubbles is a traditional cider strain, beautiful for fruit juice-based fermentations. Imperial says the clean profile of the yeast, especially when used at the lower end of the fermentation range, allows the nuances of the fruit to be prominent in the finished bubbly beverage. The strain is produced on 100% gluten-free media, hence the name A40GF. Imperial says Bubbles isn't recommended for wort fermentations, but it would be great for delicious fruit beverages or mead. I've got another jar of local honey from Caleb the beekeeper, 3 pounds of honey, that I would love to use in a fruited mead. And Steve says he's tempted to use Bubbles in a blueberry mead. So, there's some good stuff coming along. We love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because I don't use starters anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. With a pitch rate in every easy-to-open pouch of 200 billion cells and a recommended shelf life of 4 months, you'll be happy too. Ask your local homebrew shop for Imperial Organic Yeast or go to imperialyeast.com to check out all the wonderful yeasty options. I spent Monday brewing the next round of the malt sampler. This time we're going to tackle dark specialty malts. Steve suggested we do Black Patent, Black Prinz, and Midnight Wheat. It's going to be a fun and challenging one for sure. I can tell you, the kitchen smelled great, all roasty and malty. I used American two-row as the base, or what Brees refers to as brewer's malt. That harkens back to the previous malt sampler show where I gave Steve the opportunity to defend using the term two-row as a generic descriptor in writing recipes. He's for it. And that discussion prompted an email from Christian. Christian says, "Just a comment about the two-row discussion I found interesting from the last episode. I'm Swedish, living in Norway, married with a Brit. I've lived and brewed a lot in all of those countries, and I have to say I've not ever come across two-row as you do in the States. It's kept me confused for years of what it is. Go online on any brew sites in Europe and you won't find a generic two-row. They simply categorize all the two-row in a list of two-row malts, but they are not sold as just two-row. You pick your Maris Otter or whatever, but you can't buy 2 kilograms of a generic two-row." Christian says, "My local homebrew store, biggest in Norway, by the way, they don't have a two-row bin. You choose your two-row variety." I don't get it. What should the generic two-row be? Golden Promise? Pilsner malt? Whenever I've heard brewers from the States speaking of two-row in recipes, I've stopped listening because you simply cannot find it. Or at least I have not found it in Europe after brewing for 8 years. Please help me. What's going on?" Thanks, Christian. We just file this in the same folder as our obsession with ignoring the metric system, I guess. Just pick your favorite base malt to use, and you might wind up with a better beer in the end. Who knows? I appreciate the letter. Hey, if you want to buy American Two Row or a whole bunch of other delicious malts and ingredients, head on over to our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave of HighGravityBrew.com. With their Build Your Own Beer page, you can see the ingredients of a well-stocked homebrew store all on one scrolling page. It's a long page, but it's very well organized. Base malts, specialty grains, hops, yeast, adjuncts, flavorings, everything you need to brew a delicious beer. And your total calculates at the bottom of the window, always visible for you to track your order as you shop. And don't forget, HighGravityBrew.com has been the home of awesome electric brewing gear since before it was cool. Dave builds Warthog systems to order right there in the back of the shop. You know I love my Warthog single vessel system from High Gravity, but if you'd rather go more traditional, HighGravityBrew.com has two or three vessel systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels. HighGravityBrew.com can help you take the pain out of propane. Especially when the weather gets colder and the wind wants to steal the heat from your old propane burner. Just when you're out there battling that, just think you need to make the switch to an electric system. Treat yourself. Be nice to yourself. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Okay, we first got to know Adam Ross when he came on to give the counterpoint to Chris Colby's less-than-favorable opinions of brown ale. I had so much fun talking to Adam that I decided to check in to see what fun brews he's been brewing at the brand-new Twin Span Brewing. Adam Ross, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Yeah, glad to be back, James.
It's been all the way back in April that I had you on defending brown ale. It didn't seem like that long, but I had such...
Really? This year has been a hell of a decade for me. So. You said April, and I'm like, really? That's ages ago, man.
Well, this is only like June, isn't it?
I don't know what day it is.
Yeah, it's just whizzing by. But I had such a fun time talking to you that I decided to ping you and see what you're up to. Now bring us up to speed. You're at Twin Span Brewing up there in the Davenport area, Davenport, Iowa. And when we talked to you, you were just getting ramped up. So how are things going now?
Yeah, actually, and we're actually Bettendorf, which is next door to Davenport. I don't know if anyone from either city listens or cares. There, it's right on the border between the two cities. But yeah, we opened May 9th, officially opened for business, which was after we recorded the podcast. So it's been wild, and we just crossed the 4-month period, and to me it's been breakneck speed, but it feels like we've been open for over a year. I mean, it's just, there's a lot that goes into running a brewery and opening a brewery, apparently.
turns out.
Surprisingly. Yeah, so, and we opened during the pandemic, which is, I don't know, crazy or maybe a good idea. It allowed us to open staggered. So May 9th, we just sold beer to go out. We had this big window that opens into our patio, and people could order online and pick up their beer. And we just had day one, we just had relied on people bringing in their own growlers, and we had a couple cans. And then we slowly opened up to getting our own official growlers, starting up our kitchen, having food to go as well. And then we opened up our outdoor patio, and so people couldn't quite come inside yet. And we're doing all this aligning with the restrictions around the pandemic, but also we have been playing it very safe. I mean, the last thing we want is for anyone to get the virus, and especially from us. We opened, let people inside quite a while after the Iowa restrictions allowed us to do so. And we're still at 50% capacity. We're still keeping limits on group sizes, on how close people can get together. All our staff are wearing masks and gloves at all times. We're sanitizing everything between every customer. But we've been doing well. We've been, for the most part, I think, basically at capacity most of the time. People seem to want to stop in and check us out. They love our patio. We have a really nice big patio beer garden. I've given myself the goal of releasing a new beer every Wednesday, and that's been a challenge. I don't know why I agreed to that, but it keeps people coming in. We have some super fans, which is nice, and the weekly thing allows me to do some pretty bizarre styles that we'll talk about today. But it also pushes me to be maybe a little more economical in how I brew and plan out variations of brews, and try to, you know, use what I have on hand. It's a bit like the quarantine kitchen scenario a lot of us are in. You know, we don't get to go to the grocery store all the time, so we just try to make use with what we have on hand, and it results in some stuff you might not have planned on in the first place.
Well, good. It's good that you're finding a silver lining there. And you posted a video on YouTube of your operation, and it's beautiful. You know, the serving side and you know, back of the house is with the brewing stuff is, you know, it's a gorgeous setup. So congratulations.
We really wanted to go for it's a little contemporary, but a little mix of modern and rustic. So we've had people call us fancy, which I never thought I would be brewing at a fancy brewery, but here we are, and now I just got to make the beer live up to the fancy expectations.
people are required to put their pinkies out when they're right. Drinking their pints. Yeah.
And yeah, it's been I mean, really, we're still trying to find our customer base and what people like and what they don't like. I and totally flummoxed that our bestseller consistently has been my little British golden ale. So it's under 4% alcohol, and it's got Scottish malt, and it's a style that not many people know about. And it features, so it's basically like a light bitter, only it features a American hops. So mine has Eldorado, a pretty big chart of Eldorado, and people love that one. And that's I would not have guessed that that small beer would be the best seller.
Well, you sent me a list of beers that you've been brewing, just as a, you know, as to, kind of stuff to pick from to talk about, and I picked two weird ones, Dampf beer and Tapache, and I picked them just mainly because I wanted to say Dampf beer and Tapache. it's like a Quinn Martin production from the 1970s. You know? This week on Dampf beer and Tapache, Huggy Bear.
Yeah, just like that that brewery in Bavaria. What's it called, James?
yeah, and you've made fun of my pronunciation of Weinstaffen.
Yeah, you got it.
Is that close?
Yeah, pretty close. I mean, I'm no expert at pronouncing it either. I know a little German and I know a little Spanish, but I'm still going to mispronounce a bunch talking about these beers today. But yeah, I was in Germany and at a hotel near Weinstaffen, and that's when the concierge corrected my pronunciation. I got a lot of weird looks. What are you asking for?
And he probably let you dangle in the wind a little bit while right? You struggled.
I didn't call it Wheezy Steven, but I after hearing that video I sent you where people are mispronouncing it, I'm gonna brew a beer called Wheezy Steven because that's fantastic.
I'm surprised nobody has so far.
Right.
So let's talk about. So I can't remember hearing about Dampf beer before, but you know it's been 716 or 70 whatever episodes. So you know, who knows? Back in 2006, we might have covered it, but I don't think we have. But I've been asked about Tapache lately. Somebody, you know, a couple people have emailed me. You know, why don't y'all do a video on making Tapache? It's fun to do and simple. So why don't we start with the simple one that is a fermentation. You wouldn't really call it a beer, would you? It's a fermented beverage, though.
Yeah, it's not a beer. It's fermentation with fruit that is often added to beer. So that's the tie-in. And I did brew a Tapache at Twinspan, and we had to look into before I did it state law to make sure that we were classified to be able to do that. But yeah, it's interesting. People have been asking you about it recently. It seems to have gotten a little trendy on the internet this year. I even saw an article online about, or a couple articles about Tapache getting huge in some of the regions where they grow pineapples. Because during the pandemic, a lot of these countries have closed down liquor stores and people just can't get the booze that they want / need. And so they've turned to homebrewing using what they have on hand, which is pineapples.
And this is a quote-unquote spontaneously fermented beverage. So this ties in with a couple episodes ago that we talked to Sandor Katz about fermenting vegetables. But unlike with the fermenting vegetables, where it's a lactic fermentation, and you're not, you know, fermenting, turning sugar to alcohol, with the Tapache, you are actually making alcohol. You're using wild yeasts to turn sugar into alcohol.
Yeah. So I first heard about it a few years ago from a bartender friend who had made a Tapache bar syrup. And so I looked into it, and really it boils down to and why I like Tapache so much. I think it's such a cool idea is you're using the scraps of a pineapple. So you cut up a pineapple, and I mean, no one ever does a perfect cut, so there's still some meat left on the rind. And you throw those rinds into a thing of water, and then you add sugar and you let it spontaneously ferment over a few days. And that's essentially all it is. You're relying on the yeast that's still on the skin of the pineapple, plus whatever yeast is resident in the sugar that you use or in the air or the vessel that you put it in. Mm-hmm. But when I made it the first time, I just had a half-gallon Tupperware container, and I carved up a pineapple, and basically it was, you know, why not? So I threw the rind. I left the top and bottom out because I don't think anything good comes out of including those, the leaves or the whatever you call the bottom part, the stump. Yeah. And I don't know how much concern there should be over organic versus non-organic. I assume you'd want to use an organic pineapple, or at least maybe rinse off the pineapple. That potentially will wash away some of that yeast. But we're talking naturally fermented, spontaneously fermented fruit. You probably want to err on the side of caution and get organic if you can, or get, if you happen to live somewhere with pineapples nearby. I mean, why not source locally?
I mean, organic doesn't mean that they don't use pesticides. It's just a different kind of pesticide. So,
right. Yeah.
So you still, you want to rinse it off for sure. And Sandor Katz said that, you know, rinsing the vegetables, is not going to rinse off all the stuff that you want to, you know, to ferment the stuff. So, you know, as long as you're not like scrubbing with a bleach solution or something, I don't think you have to worry about, you know, cleaning it too much.
When I made it at TwinSpan, we didn't scrub. It was rinsed off, and we had no problem fermenting. And it was, yeah, like you said, organic doesn't necessarily mean pesticide free in all cases, but you probably don't want anything that has too much of a chemical cocktail on it if you can avoid it.
Right. Being a professional brewer, you know, you can't just, did you just scale up all these homebrew recipes that are all over the internet, or did you take a more scientific approach as far as figuring out, you know, like what the, you know, how much sugar to add and what your starting gravity would be and all that? Plus, I guess you got to keep track of that for regulations or reporting purposes, right?
Right. Yep. So, yeah, it was a mix of scientific and homebrew, and that, like you say, you have to record everything you produce and everything you use in the back of the house. I don't recall the exact numbers, but you add the little batch I did initially, with just a single pineapple and a half gallon container of water. I filled up enough water so that it was completely submerged. And then I added, it was a cup of brown sugar, maybe two. So it wasn't much. And I put the lid on real loose and let it ferment for 7 days. I saw quite a bit of activity. You see some bubbling. You don't see anything like a Croizen or anything like that, but you do see bubbling. After I was done with it, because you can go too far with fermentation. I mean, you're basically fermenting rotting fruit. So there is a concern there about just sipping off some of that liquid and drinking it. So I boiled mine, and the first time I did it, I then kept boiling it until I made it into a cocktail syrup. Huh. But at TwinSpan, I only gave it 3 days, and a large part of that was, this is a wild fermentation in my brand new shiny clean brewery. And it's just crazy. It's one of those things that everyone tells you don't do it. So I had a 5 gallon bucket. I had the kitchen get me 8 pineapples. So we used the rinds of 8 pineapples, and then they actually did a pretty good job peeling those or removing the skin. So I ended up also taking the meat from 2 pineapples and putting it in a 5 gallon bucket. And to be traditional, your sugar source should be piloncillo. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't source that in a good enough amount of time. So I used dark brown sugar, which I've heard is pretty similar. They're both kind of a dark molasses type flavor. And I used, so we're talking at this point, we're at about 3 gallons of water, 3.5. And 4 pounds of brown sugar. I did not take a gravity reading. I think it would be challenging to do with as the sugars break down in the pineapples, mm-hmm. and how they contribute to gravity.
Yeah.
And then I did boil because I didn't want anyone to get sick. I mean, it's only 3 days, and it wasn't very funky at that point. But I had seen activity, and it had changed in flavor, and so I wanted to make sure I knocked out anything that was in there.
Yeah, traditionally, the recipes that I've seen, some people boil the water beforehand, like to maybe to dissolve the sugar more easily, but then others don't. And then most say, you know, after 3 to maybe 5 days, you know, start drinking it, put it in the fridge. And some people carbonate it, but although, you know, that seems dangerous,
right.
Sticking it in a bottle and putting the lid on. But, yeah, I can see where in the commercial environment you would want to err on the side of caution, as far as, you know, not wanting to make people sick. But
and there isn't too much, I'm not aware of really, at least not in North America, any commercial tepache. There may be in the Southwest, actually, now that I had read something about that, but certainly not up here in the Midwest. You can't find commercially brewed tepache, but apparently in Mexico, it's all over the place in street markets and street vendors. And from what I've heard is there are no rules governing that you have to boil anything. There's no rules that say you have to stop after 3 to 5 days. And actually, the tepache I made, one of our bartenders, was from Mexico, and he tried it, and he said that, and he goes, yeah, probably should have given it a couple more days, because it wasn't quite to where he remembered it.
Just on being funky, or?
Yeah. So if you haven't tasted tepache before, there is quite a bit of pineapple in there, as you said. And some brown sugar, molasses flavor. But then there's this earthy flavor from the rind. And there's a little bit of that wild, you know, sour or kind of Brett-type funkiness to it. And the one I did for 7 days was quite funky. I mean, it would have been a little challenging to go through a full, you know, pint or whatever of it. Oh, and one other thing, you should add spices. That's traditional. So I added just cinnamon, but you can also add cloves. You can add anise. You can even add peppers like jalapenos into it. And there's a couple interesting videos on YouTube about people brewing it. There's one, I think it's Bon Appetit Labs or one of those test kitchen video series. He ferments it with peppers and goes in depth into the process. But yeah, I just added cinnamon and quite a bit of cinnamon. And like I said, boiled it. And then I didn't sell it just straight as is. It would have been no more than 2 or 3% alcohol, which maybe people wouldn't have cared. But I added it to a Kolsch that I had made. A lot of the tepache gets, since it is low in alcohol, they'll add basically, they'll mix it with a light, lager or some light beer, and they'll kind of do a beer cocktail out of it. And so I went that track and added it to some of my Kolsch. And the the response was positive. We have a couple of members of staff that are from Mexico or visit often, and they were all excited to hear that I was tackling it, and they said it was good. They said I'd done good. So I still haven't personally had a quote, you know, real tepache from Mexico. I almost say commercial, but I'm like, well, mine was commercially sold, I guess.
Well, that sounds fun. Fun and easy if you can get a fresh pineapple and, you know, People like it, especially people who listen to this show, like to experiment and ferment stuff. So, yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and if you already have a pineapple, I mean, the rest is just going to waste. Why not put it to work?
Yeah. Keep it out of the compost heap.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break from talking to Adam to talk about our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell Meadery. If you've been listening to the show lately, you know you can order delicious craft meads directly from Groenfell and have them sent to your house. I asked Ricky what's new this week at Groenfell, and he said, we now offer build-your-own variety cases that automatically get 10% off and free shipping. Holy smokes. Not a big fan of ginger, Ricky says. Now you can skip the root of all evil and grab another 4-pack of a sour or one of our seasonals. And if you mention in the notes on your order that you heard about us on Basic Brewing Radio and that you enjoyed the episode, you get the free bonus of knowing that you made the Honorable James Spencer's week. Oh, that Ricky. Seriously, give us a shout out and thank Ricky and Kelly for their support of the show when you place your order. Groenfell and Chaos Meads are really delicious and quaffable. Check them out at family-owned and operated groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. So the other is a more traditional style that the Dampf beer, or is that translate to steam beer?
It does.
But this is not to be confused with the Anchor steam beer.
Well, so funny you say that. I asked this past week a buddy of mine who lives in Bavaria. He's lived there his whole life. And I said, what do you know about Dampf beer? And he goes, well, I've had Anchor steam. What else do you mean? And so, I mean, that tells me a lot because this guy, he likes this beer and he knows this stuff. And for him to just be like, I haven't heard of Dampf beer is, I think, tells a lot about the state of it.
Yeah, it makes me feel better.
Yeah, it's like you said, it does translate literally into steam beer. And there's a lot of connection, a lot of similarities with the steam beer that we know in the U.S., popularized by Anchor Steam.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically before I get to the story, so how I stumbled upon it was a couple of years ago, I was trying to brew a clone of Weinstephan's Kristallweizen, which is, if you've never had it, it's just a lovely beer. It's a Hefeweizen, basically, and they've filtered out the haze, and a lot of some of the body goes with it as well. And it's just this crystal clear kind of wheat beer. And from a homebrew level, that's challenging to make unless you have something like a plate filter. So I was trying to clone that, and one of my attempts, I asked the homebrew shop to get my grain bill, and after I got home and added to the mash, he called me and said that he forgot to actually add the wheat to the beer. So I was like, well, I already had everything else on hand, and I said, I'm just going to go forward with it, and what do I call this thing? And so I started Googling for what do you call a Weizen without wheat? And that's really how I pitched it to our servers and customers at TwinSpan, because no one knew what a Dampf beer was. I said, tell them it's just it's a Hefeweizen without wheat.
Hmm. And so it's an all barley beer, but it's fermented with wheat beer yeast?
Yeah. So this is where we get into the story and whether or not it's a style really, or just marketing spin, or however you want to look at it. But the story is that in the late 19th century in eastern Bavaria along the Czech border, there was this poor farmer, and all he had access to was barley. He didn't have access to wheat, and he couldn't get access to any yeast other than this kind of Weizen yeast. So it's very much a farmhouse style. It's a farmhouse beer. And it almost shares more in common with something like a Saison than with Hefeweizen. And that's so late 19th century in America, we're coming up with a style called steam beer. And it's people who have access to limited grain and yeast. I mean, all they had on hand from the German brewers was lager yeast, but they're in a warm climate. So they come up with this style of this beer that its bones are an ale, but it's fermented with lager yeast. And then you get the, you know, the romantic story behind it, and that it's called a steam beer because they cooled it on the roof and they saw all the steam evaporating into the sky. I think that's really just a coincidence, interestingly, that on the other halfway around the world, there's this other steam beer being invented with a similar origin story.
Hmm.
In the case of Dampf beer, it gets the steam name from the fact that at this point in history, no one was really brewing Weizenbiers anymore. They kind of fell out of favor 100 years earlier in the late 1700s. And I don't know where they found this yeast, but they didn't have temperature control, and they didn't have the clean lager yeast that was taking over the world at the time with Pilsners. And so they added this Weizen yeast, and they fermented it warm, and it top fermented. And the brewers were surprised at seeing this foam and the activity and how vigorous it was fermenting. And they said it's like it's boiling, and the Kreuzen is like steam. And so that's their romantic story of how they came up with the name of steam beer.
Ah. And so does it have the character of a wheat beer?
Yeah, it really does. And I had it on tap at the same time I have my traditional Weiss beer on at Twinspan. And I was encouraging people, hey, get a sample of each because they're very similar and also very different. So a lot of those things that make a wheat beer don't actually come from the wheat. Wheat at most contributes to body and the haziness in Hefeweizens. The rest is pretty much the work of the yeast.
Hmm.
So you do get this Dampf beer is wheatless Hefeweizen. And that's how I went about brewing it at Twinspan. It was actually a smash. It was Pilsner. I used Urillo hops and then this Hefeweizen yeast, and I fermented it at actually quite warm on this one because I had heard fermented warm, and so I assumed upper end warm, so like 72 degrees, 74, and it came out clear and not with just a huge body, but it had a lot of those esters, some banana, and a lot of bubble gum.
Now, with a wheat beer or with a Hefeweizen, I've heard it is said that you, in order to get the most of the banana and the clove and all that stuff, you do a ferulic acid rest at 122 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be around 50 C. Is that correct? I mean, it's been a long time since I talked about wheat beers, but you're supposed to do a low temperature rest in order to get those ingredients that make the fun phenolic flavors. Did you have to do that with this beer?
Yeah, so we're talking Germans here. So if you hear these dogma, take it with a grain of salt. I'm probably going to get in trouble by a bunch of Germans by saying that. But there's a reason they're known for making some of the best beer in the world, and a lot of that is these rules, and that makes sense for these breweries and for these customers. But the ferulic acid rest is really only necessary if you want to enhance the clove phenols in the beer. If you, and a lot of American palates don't really like the clove, they prefer the banana, but in Europe, it's from what I've seen and heard, it's flipped. So there is a lot of talk about ferulic acid rest, but really you can brew this just like you would in you don't even need a step mash. You can do it just like a single infusion mash. And I have to guess that's how it was originally brewed, because the story is this is a farmer brewing it. He doesn't have expensive equipment. He doesn't have temperature control. So he's really just a single temperature, likely.
Right.
And he doesn't, another part of the story is that and what drives the style today is he didn't even necessarily have access to just the best barley even. So there's essentially one brewery out there today in Zwiesel. That's eastern Bavaria in the Bavarian forest. That still brews Dampfbier, and they're actually called the Zwiesel Dampfbier Brewery. He had access to darker brown malt, is what they said. They say kind of amber or brown malt. And doing some more research, I found that today they're sourcing all of their stuff from Bamberg nearby. Bamberg is the home of Weyermann, which a lot of us are homebrewers and commercial brewers are familiar with their products. Mm-hmm. So I would actually, if I were to rebrew it, and I likely will, I wouldn't use a Pilsner base because it's not historically accurate, even though it was delicious. I'd go with something like a dark Munich malt or one of their slightly, you know, amber brown colored Munich malts.
Huh. Be a little more rustic.
Yeah, and it would certainly change the profile of the beer from mine with Pilsner, which was really crisp and great for hot weather, to probably something a little, probably better for this time of year with, you know, weather cooling and people expecting a little more richness from the malt.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a banana Oktoberfest kind of a thing.
Yeah, could be.
So were there any challenges with, it sounds like a pretty easy brew.
Yeah. If you take the approach of it being, a farmhouse brew, yeah, it's an easy brew in that you maybe don't need to do temperature control and you can just blame it on it being a rustic farmhouse style. But yeah, if you really want to dip into, the yeast is so temperamental. If you really want to get in the direction you want to go with that, it does require a bit of work. Side note on that, actually, and I hadn't thought of this in a while until I was getting ready to talk to you about this, James, but I think it was 10 years ago, you and BYO through Chris Colby had one of the experiments with that I participated in.
Oh.
And it was on whether or not the trub or the fallout from the boil should be included in the fermenter.
Right.
And I did that with a Weiss beer. And the half that didn't get any trub was super banana-y. And the half that had all the junk from the kettle was clove bum.
Huh.
Totally different beers. I had it in front of my homebrew club. There was, I don't know, 30 people. And we did the blind tasting thing, and not a single person got it wrong.
Wow.
I mean, they knew which was which. And so that's part of what that really makes that yeast tick, is if you give it everything at once, it results in this clovey, kind of tends toward clean fermentation profile. If you stress it out a little bit, you start to get those banana and fruit. And if you stress it out too much, you get bubblegum characteristics. And so that's where you can start playing with things like the mash.
And pitch rates, I would assume.
Yeah, and pitch rates. So you could do the ferulic acid rest if you really wanted to enhance the clove character. I'd be careful though with that, because barley has more ferulic acid than wheat. So if you went with a ferulic acid rest, you'd get quite a bit of clove character.
Huh.
And I would go with standard mashing otherwise. I mean, you know, 154 would be fine, 152. And in terms of water, I would think you'd lean towards Munich. And that's what I did for my Dampfbier. But Zwiesel is actually much closer to Pilsen. So their water might be actually a little more that crisper, you know, more gypsum type profile. That is something I wasn't able to figure out in any of these Dampfbiers, what their water profile was.
So would you strike a balance and you know, let a little of the protein from the kettle into the fermenter, or is that kind of like a matter of preference?
I would say matter of preference. Commercially, we're whirlpooling all our beers, so little to no junk gets in the fermenters. But when I was homebrewing, I was using most of all of it because it's, you know, it's extra food. So, so when I do my Weizen at Twinspan, I don't use yeast nutrient like I do with a lot of my beers, and I don't oxygenate.
Oh.
At all. It's just the splashing of going into the fermenter that gives it the oxygen. And it's quite a nice bit of banana with just a hint of clove. And I keep fermentation on that under 68 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, 20 C? Because if you go too warm, you get that bubblegum bomb. Mm-hmm. But if you were to go down to, say, 64 F, 18 C, you would certainly be getting more of that clove character. And the story of Spiesel's Dampf beer is that they stick between 64 to 68 degrees, 18 to 20 C, for fermentation. And they call that warm, or quite warm, actually. And so I would think they would go on the lower end of that little scale.
Talk about your hopping strategy.
Yeah, so for mine, I just did a little bittering charge. Before I did the research, I did a little bittering charge, and I put in a lot of Urillo at the end because I just like that hop, and this is something different, so why not? No one would tell me I made a bad Dampf beer, I thought. So Spiesel apparently does a hour and a half boil, and they add a small addition 20 minutes into the boil, 40 minutes, and then 75 minutes. So your latest hop addition is 15 minutes before you turn off the heat. Mm. And every story says that this farmer in the 19th century could barely get his hands on any hops either. So I would assume you would go really low hopping on it. I'm not sure what Zwiesel's getting at by doing multiple additions throughout kind of a preservative thing.
Yeah,
maybe they're getting some.
You wouldn't think
character.
That being a hop bomb or a bitter hop bomb would be complementary to the yeast character.
Right. And from what I've heard of reviews of people online of those who have tried Spiesel Dampf beer commercially, they say it's a sweet beer. Mm. One comment was that it's kind of like a sweet alt beer.
Oh, well, that sounds good. And
yeah, it does.
And people liked it?
Yeah, and I actually had a couple. I had mentioned I didn't think anyone would call me out on the Dampf beer. I had this group of gentlemen who are with the Potosi Historical Brewing Society stop in. They're like, hey, tell me everything you know about Dampf beer, and let's try it. And so, yeah, they seemed to like it, and they had Dampf beer from other American breweries, and they said it was keeping in that tradition, which is funny because everything I've seen on homebrew forums is typically a lot of people are using character malts, like crystal malts, and darker. They're blending a bunch of malts together. Very few are going with the smash type of setup that I assume historically brewers would have done.
The older I get, I don't know if it's because I'm getting more lazy or my tastes are simplified, but I tend to lean toward fewer grains, you know, more toward the smash approach than I used to like to put a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but nowadays I'm just like, it's going to be good.
Right. Yeah. You know? Same with me. Commercially, when I brew a 10 to 15 barrel batch, I'm not splitting bags. So if I calculate, scale up my recipe from 5 gallons to 550 gallons and it calls for 67 pounds of this grain, grain bags come in 55 pound increments. So that recipe gets changed to 55 pounds of grain. So I'm not going to be have these bags sitting around everywhere that are partially open. So, yeah, fewer grains and also less precision, I guess, around how much is used.
Yeah, and you know, it'll be a little different, but, you know, probably not perceptibly
right. different. That's what I found, yeah.
And, you know, I've started the same approach on hops. You know, they come in 1 ounce bags, and usually if I save like half an ounce in a bag in the freezer, fold it over, it's not going to get used. So,
right.
So I just go ahead and toss it in, you know, depending on, you know, in the boil, depending on how high the alpha acid is. You know, I wouldn't like substitute, you know, a whole ounce as opposed to, you know, a quarter ounce in a small batch of a, you know, 13% alpha acid hop at the beginning of a 60 minute boil. But I might, you know, chunk those in at the end of the boil
right.
or in a pop stand or something. So, yeah, I'm getting less persnickety, I guess.
You're relaxing and not worrying and having a homebrew.
There you go. Yeah, you should put that on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, brilliant.
I don't remember hearing that before. See, I am getting old. Now this has been fun. Any other notes on the Dumpf beer before we wrap it up?
Yeah, if you want to really geek out about the history and dig into your own research like I did, there's a word of warning. There was, at the same time in Germany, brewers were making Dampf beers that had absolutely nothing to do with this. And I spent quite a bit more time than I should have reading really old German text before realizing that Dampf beer for them meant it was brewed using a steam heating system versus fire beers, which I thought at first was a cool new style, or a style people had forgotten about that I had discovered. But they were really just doing these experiments, and steam beer brewing was starting to take hold, and there's this common belief that steam beers wouldn't be as good. They wouldn't have as full a body, and they wouldn't have as much color and flavor, and so why even bother with this new technology? And they were doing, there's quite a bit of, if you use like the Google historic book search, most or many of the entries on Dampf beer are just brewing scientists in the 19th century arguing over the qualities of one style versus the other. And interesting read. They actually did some kind of like brewlosophy type experiments where they had a bunch of people blind to the method of brewing try the beers, and people weren't seeing a significant difference, and then they were like, hey, surprise, it was steam beer all along. And so it was fun, but also if you want to start really going beyond the homebrew forums and what people are saying about Dampf beer historically, there isn't much at all out there. I mean, one or two breweries have ever even brewed it in Germany commercially, and one of them still occasionally makes a Dampf beer that, from what I can tell, has nothing to do with this style of Dampf beer. it's even lager yeast, and it's light in color, and I don't know.
So did the trademark attorneys from the original Dampf beer sue the others and have them call it German Common?
I don't think so.
It's a little obscure right. beer joke there. I don't know if anybody will get it.
I don't think the Germans are that vindictive or litigious. It's more of like, I think what happens in that case is they're like, hey, I found this handwritten document where my great-great-grandfather was brewing down here, and the other person's like, oh, okay. You have the claim, and we'll just keep selling our stuff over here.
Well, excellent. Like I say, this has been fun. If you're open to coming back, it would be fun to have you back on to talk about some other experiments that you're doing down the line.
Yeah, I do, as you can tell, like to talk about beer and brewing. And I am continuing the historic research with some brewing, and I'm kind of pushing on the edges of what my customers all actually drink. Next week, I'm releasing a Scottish light that's 2.3% alcohol.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a little worried about that one. People like, I don't know if you know this, but people like booze. And so I try to keep it as real as possible to the style you can't get in the U.S. because it's such a fragile, gentle beer. But yeah, and then I've got some 19th century recipes I found that maybe this winter they're a little rough around the edges. Maybe they'll fit in when things get really cold. I'll start brewing those.
Well, cool. All right, Adam, take care and brew lots of fun stuff. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Jane.
Thanks again to Adam. I'm looking forward to hearing what fun things he brews next. That is quite the challenge. New brew every week. I'm really interested in brewing that Dampf beer myself. Sounds like a really fun beer that maybe I can trick my beer geek friends into thinking it's wheat beer. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.